Foundation, Hunger Games. 3 months after the last aid truck entered, with ribs protruding all over the strip, with Israeli troops guarding all of the borders, not letting in a truck or a plane or a ship. And then with barbed wire and machine guns, the drones and the snipers take aim at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games. People walk for 10 or 20 miles to find soldiers everywhere when they arrive, who give them 20 minutes to fight for food, and then with ammunition live, the snipers, drones, and tanks mow them down, morning after morning, just the same, at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Hunger Games.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, as the 23rd month of Israel's genocide in Gaza approaches, the scale of the rogue state's criminality is difficult to imagine, let alone catalog. But historians will have to wait. The worst is not over as Israel begins to repeat the horrors practiced in Gaza in the West Bank. Dr. Dorotea Gucciardo is the Director of Development for GLIA Equal Care and leads GLIA.org's Open Gaza Initiative project. She's a literal eyewitness to the Gaza genocide and member of Eyewitness Gaza, a coalition of health professionals, aid workers, community leaders, and others who are calling out policymakers and the media for their failures to reveal and demand an end to Israel's 21st century Holocaust. Welcome back to the show, Dorotea.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Dorotea, on August 8th, you reported a leaked memo detailing the disturbing development in the relationship between the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and the United Nations, one that calls for, quote, lowering rhetoric and working, quote, in parallel with GHF. Can we begin, Dorotea, with who GHF is and why, as you say, following the suggested precepts is not a great idea for the welfare of the people of Gaza?
Yeah, absolutely. So GHF stands for Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. But that is a name that we shouldn't be fooled by, because it is not a humanitarian organization in any way, shape, or form. It's a facade. So it's an Israeli construct that is funded largely by the United States, but some reports are coming out suggesting that funding is also coming from Israel and European countries. And so this money is concentrated in these hands, and it goes to this organization, which is then also supported militarily by the IOF and by American mercenaries. So these are former combat veterans who come in ostensibly to be the ones to deliver aid to Palestinians. And the first question people should be asking themselves is, why do we need armed contractors to distribute aid? And what it is a reflection of what GHF actually is. It is not an aid organization. It is another extension of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli military in the form of militarized aid. So since March of this year, when reports of this organization began to surface, those of us in the international humanitarian community have been ringing the alarm bells, because everything about the idea of militarized aid runs counter to the principles of humanitarianism. And so we knew there was going to be a problem, and in practice, indeed, there has been a problem. The GHF, its system, has replaced the UN system inside Gaza for aid distribution. So prior to the GHF, there were about 400 sites located throughout the Gaza Strip. With the GHF, we have four sites, all located in the south. And so it causes this funneling effect where Palestinians located throughout the Strip are expected to travel to these GHF sites in order to acquire food packages. But what we've seen over time has been horror after horror after horror being reported on the ground in terms of Palestinians being injured and being killed as a result of trying to get aid, trying to get food. So we have a population that has been under complete siege since March 2nd, starving right? My staff reporting that everybody is essentially skin and bones at this point, desperate to get food, traveling sometimes upwards of 12 to 15 kilometers on foot to try to access an aid package, and then being met with bullets, being met with shrapnel, being met with fire from drones from above. And so this is not a humanitarian initiative. This is a militarized spectacle that is being used as a veneer of aid to continue the occupation and to continue the genocide against Palestinians.
And we've seen that more than 1,000 have been killed at these so-called aid sites. I remember when there was the flower massacre, and mm-hmm. this was a singular event. It was a shocking, amidst this torrent of shocking acts and events going on, but it seemed to be a signal moment. Oh, they killed a bunch of people as they came at an aid distribution point. Now that has become so regularized, it seems like it happens daily and with much greater effect.
Correct. And in fact, I would caution against even calling them aid distribution sites, because they're not. Mm-hmm. They're death traps. They're designed to lure weak, starving Palestinians into a small area where they can then be essentially massacred. And we have seen massacres every single time the GHF has opened the area for Palestinians to come and try to get some food, every single time. And we're seeing all measures of depravity, right? Doctors are reporting that some days patients that are coming in from these massacres have all been shot in the eye, or they've all been shot in the chest, or they've all been shot in the groin. These are not accidents. These are deliberate, systemic attacks against a defenseless population that is just trying to survive. It's appalling. It's depraved. It's deranged. It is not aid. It is, as I said, an extension of Israel's genocide in Gaza.
Well, right from the beginning, getting rid of UNRWA, the UN aid organization that is taking care of providing aid in Gaza largely for, I don't know, decades, we saw how Israel claimed that they were working with Hamas and that they were Hamas agents, and they've been trying to shut it down all along. And now it seems that it's entirely successful. They've also killed a couple hundred, if I remember rightly, UNRWA workers. Now mm-hmm. we're seeing the same language in the West Bank. We're seeing that INGOs are being vetted by the military. It's creating a chill throughout the aid distribution for the West Bank as well. What's going on there?
There's actually a few things to break down in your question. And the first thing is you brought up UNRWA, and rightfully so, as one of these first organizations that were instrumental in providing aid to Palestinians being delegitimized by Israel. But there was actually a step that was taken just before that. So if we take a look at the timeline after October 7, the first thing that the Israelis did before they attempted to delegitimize any international organization was to raise all of the agricultural land in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And that's really important, because what a lot of people don't realize is that, okay, so we know that the Gaza Strip was under occupation and it was under blockade. It was already suffering from this brutal military siege where the Israelis only decided what and who could go in. Well, some of the things that they didn't allow in were, you know, ingredients that you would find in fertilizers, right? And so the Palestinians in Gaza innovated because of necessity and ended up creating one of, if not the world's largest organic agricultural farm, right? So they succeeded in creating a lively agricultural hub to self-sustain. And so after October 7, one of the very first things that the Israelis did was raise all of that agricultural land. They made it virtually impossible for the Palestinians to continue farming. Then they began their attacks on the international organizations. And we see similar raising of agricultural land in the West Bank. It's a little bit more symbolic than in Gaza, because the West Bank, you know, we're looking at olive trees and individual family farms. The West Bank, compared to Gaza, has had a longer history of being dependent on international aid. And so the attack on international organizations has come a little bit more quickly. And it can get very confusing, right? Because we're all talking about this violence that's happening in Gaza, and rightfully so, all eyes on Gaza. But we all need to remember that Gaza is part of occupied Palestine, right? The Israelis are performing this genocide throughout the land. And one of their methods of this genocide is through bureaucracy, right? It's bureaucratic violence. So what we're seeing in the West Bank, more immediately in the past couple of weeks, is what's being called almost like this deregistration process. So it's not unusual for any international organization to need to register in the place where they want to be providing services. And there was a pretty long, formally established process for how to register in order to provide aid, either in the West Bank or in Gaza. And so what the Israelis started to do in December of last year was change the rules a little bit, right? They created this interministerial committee. I don't know what that means. I don't think there's a group of people just sitting around the table deciding these things. They just gave this name of an interministerial committee that decides which organizations can stay, which organizations are no longer allowed. And the criteria for being able to provide aid is so broad and unspecific that they could decide based on almost any reason to not let somebody provide aid. So they could say an organization that has made an anti-Israeli statement is no longer welcome here. They could say that any person who works for an organization that has perhaps promoted the Palestinian resistance is reflective of that organization and is no longer welcome here. And they can also decline or deny someone's registration for no stated reason, right? They don't actually have to give a reason. So they've replaced an established, fairly open process with one that is now happening behind closed doors. And so organizations that were registered in the West Bank have to reapply, they have to register, they have to comply by all of these rules, some of which are ethically questionable and legally break laws in the home state of those countries. So one of the clear example of that is that the Israelis are demanding the names and the contact information of every single Palestinian staff member. Why on earth would an international organization provide the names of the aid workers to the entity that is massacring them? It raises both ethical concerns, but also privacy concerns, like actual legal regulations in the home states of these countries. And so international organizations are pushing back. But all the only power these organizations have is power in numbers and trying to draw attention to these issues, because who is holding Israel accountable? Really, at this point, I haven't seen anybody in the international community stepping in, but they need to, because what I'm seeing in the long term is a deregistration of most international organizations and a replacement of those services with more things like the GHF, right? More Israeli-led models that aren't really designed to provide the assistance that's required at any given moment.
Well, and the need for this assistance, it's a talking point in some quarters that, oh, these Palestinian people, they can't provide for themselves. I'm seeing on my feeds, my social media feeds, I don't know if this is making the news, the television style news anymore, but account what amounts to, in my eyes anyway, is a pogrom where farmers are being raided by these gangs of settlers, heavily armed and with police and military support. Their crops are being burned, their livestock stolen, their vehicles destroyed. And this is going on, it seems, on a daily basis, as well as their territory being circumvented and they cut off from water supplies and surrounded by so-called settlements as well. But they're being slowly, their ability to provide for themselves is being slowly diminished, as well as outside trade being curtailed by the military. So they can't.
Yeah,
they need this.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. So the Israelis created the condition of the Palestinians needing aid. And then once they became fully dependent on the aid, now they're trying to delegitimize any organization that is providing that aid. And in so doing, they're going to remove international eyewitnesses from what's happening. And I know that the Palestinians are showing us. They have been showing us for a long time what is happening in occupied Palestine. The international presence, at the very least, has provided some modicum of protection. And even with that protection, look how bad it is. And so I genuinely fear what happens when that international protection is fully gone. What happens then? I can't even bear to think about it, because the horrors that we've seen when everybody is watching are already so depraved that my mind can barely process it, that I can't even imagine the depravity that will happen when the internationals are all gone.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Dorotea Gucciardo. She is Director of Development for GLIA Equal Care and leads GLIA.org's Open Gaza Initiative Project. She's been in Gaza, been a witness on the ground to the genocide there. She's a member of Eyewitness Gaza, the coalition of health professionals and aid workers, community leaders, and others who have been trying to get attention to the situation and what's going on there. If the next tile to drop, so to speak, is the West Bank, in which it seems logical that it would be, Israel's military project seems well underway. Is GLIA prepared, or are you already on the ground in the West Bank? And if not, you know, how can you help?
No. So to answer your immediate question, GLIA is not on the ground in the West Bank. At the moment, we're currently only in Gaza. We've been in Gaza since 2012, and we've pivoted to respond to this ongoing genocide. And by pivoting, you know, we initially focused our efforts in device production, especially with tourniquets early in the genocide, and distribution. Our offices were damaged in a bombing, and so we pivoted toward bringing in international healthcare workers and opening up a field clinic. That field clinic was originally located in Al Zawaida. We're moving it. It's in the process of being moved to Deir al-Balah because it was hit by shrapnel and then firmly placed in a red zone. However, we haven't let go of our medical device routes. So as you know, some of the things that we do are trying to produce clinically validated medical devices in low resource areas such as Gaza. And one of the things that we literally just started to embark on in the last week was the creation of, I guess they're like these clips or these fascinators for external fixators. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with external fixators. They're crucial when it comes to healing fractured bones, right? So there's these large steel rods that you might see a person wearing. They're external to the body that keep the bones in place, that help to keep the bones in place, especially with crush injuries, you know, which is one of the things that we've seen a lot with, you know, people's houses falling down on them. There are no more external fixators in Gaza. As I noted earlier, we've been dealing with a complete blockade since March 2nd, and anything that has come in has typically been food-related rather than medical supplies. And so we have been working on 3D printing these kind of clips or these fascinators that can be used with different sized steel poles that are available inside Gaza so that we can recreate these external fixators. So that's where we're at this moment, right? We're trying to always think about what are the needs, which are so vast, but also what are our resources and capabilities? And that's something that I say to everybody. You know, when people say to me, I don't know what to do, I'm like, well, what are you good at? You know, what's the thing that you're good at? Because that's the thing that's needed right now. And the thing that we're good at is these sort of technological fixes using scarce materials. And the external fixator seems like a natural next step for us. So actually, we should be kind of announcing it a little bit more publicly in the coming days. I believe the very first external fixator that has both steel and 3D printed components will be placed on a patient tomorrow, actually, which is really exciting. So we're hoping that we can help more people this way. So that's what we're doing. Our focus, we're not that big of an organization to also be in the West Bank, but I recognize the international efforts that are happening in the West Bank, the local efforts that are happening in the West Bank to withstand this military onslaught. And I ideologically support them, and I will speak out in defense of them. In practice, we're solely in Gaza.
Well, and what's the situation in Gaza? Every time I look, it seems the hospitals are not functioning anymore. The clinics, I mean, I know the definition of a hospital is different there than it is here. But what is the situation now? I know that Tarek Labani, who's been on this program before, the founder of GLIA, was in country the last time we spoke. What's the situation there for caregiving?
Yeah, he's still there, by the way. So Dr. Labani is still in Gaza. He's been there for about 4 months now. The healthcare infrastructure in Gaza is completely decimated. And it's a strange word. What does it mean to be decimated? You know, imagine you need to go to your the emergency room at your local hospital, and you show up, and half the building is fallen apart because it had been hit by a bomb at some point. But you make your way inside because this makeshift emergency room still kind of exists, and there's people everywhere, and there's some signs telling you where to go, but it's mostly chaotic. You have to walk over people's bodies that are on the floor, dead or alive. You have to see and hear people mourning their loved ones in all corners of this space. You're desperately looking for somebody to help you. All hands are pretty much always on deck. And when you finally are able to be seen by a medical professional, they very likely have very few tools to use. You might be bleeding, and that's what brought you there. Well, there's no gauze to stop that blood. You are probably in a lot of pain, but I'm sorry, there's no pain medication to help make you feel better, nor is there a bed for you. If we're lucky, maybe we can find a piece of cardboard to lay you down on so that your back isn't directly on the floor. It's held together by the people, right? Any movement, any measure of healthcare services that are able to be provided in Gaza right now are because of the Palestinian healthcare workers. It's because of their ingenuity. It's because of their resilience. It's because of their resourcefulness. And I caution, I'm not suggesting that they are, you know, a superhuman. Like, these are people who have been suffering a genocide for the last, 22 months, who are starving themselves, who have also lost family members themselves, who have had to bury their own family members, their neighbors, their friends, who are worried all the time that their colleagues who have been abducted by the Israelis are being tortured in prison, that they themselves may be abducted or targeted and killed. All of these things are happening at the same time. In terms of numbers, 33 out of 36 hospitals are destroyed, completely destroyed for a population of over 2 million people who are suffering massacres every single day. This is a systemic, this is by design. Right? The Israelis have deliberately targeted healthcare by design because it is the healthcare infrastructure and community that helps to support the population. And if the Israelis just cannot abide by Palestinian life. And so being in a hospital in Gaza during this genocide is both one of the most devastating experiences of your life, but it's also one of the most hopeful because you are surrounded by the humanity of the Palestinians who refuse to give up. And who love each other and who embrace each other, who mourn with each other and who celebrate the small things with each other. That's what the hospitals are like at this moment.
And for us over here, I think one of the things for myself is to see regular life going on. And it sometimes seems that people don't care at all. I can say, well, maybe they just don't know. The media here has been not great about this. They can't really convey it. I make excuses for it. Eyewitness Gaza, as I described before, you guys have been doing press conferences and trying to, you know, ring the bell in the darkness. Is Eyewitness Gaza still conducting these press conferences?
You bet. So individually, our members are doing a variety of their own forms of advocacy, whether it's media, whether it's supporting publicly other civilian measures like the Freedom Flotilla, right? Dr. Yipeng Ji has been on the front lines with that. And then collectively, we're meeting periodically to discuss the things that we can be doing to better inform the public, because I think you're right. The mainstream media has done a terrible job of accurately and fairly reporting what's happening inside Gaza. And in fact, they have been complicit in manufacturing consent for the genocide of Palestinians. And so we're thinking always about what we can be doing to be drawing better attention to what's happening in Gaza and also how people can get better involved. We're not going to stop. You know, like we're never going to stop talking, because the moment that we stop talking, the moment it suggests that something might be okay and things are not okay. And we feel a tremendous burden, those of us who have been in Gaza, because we've physically seen it. You know, we've experienced it. We've made friends with Palestinians inside Gaza, and we feel a duty to them, but also to all Palestinians, to report what we're seeing, what's happening, and being accurate in what we're saying, in order to combat a lot of the false narratives that are coming out. So I can't point to any specific upcoming events that Eyewitness Gaza in particular is going to be launching, let's say, but we're certainly not going to stop talking, and we're trying a variety of different methods in order to draw attention and to sustain attention to what's happening in Gaza and all of occupied Palestine.
Well, and I'm looking at your Twitter feed, Dorothea Gucciardo. The GLIA project, there's a solidarity in crisis, resistance, survival, and healthcare. It was a couple of weeks ago. I missed it. Is there a way that I can go and see that seminar?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's a couple things to be said about that seminar. Two things. One, the topic was a bit of a double entendre, right? Solidarity in crisis. What does that mean? Solidarity for those of us who are in solidarity with Palestinians who are suffering this crisis, but also the idea that our solidarity is in crisis because so many of us don't really know what to do. And so we brought in some leading voices in healthcare, Palestinian American voices mostly, but also British. Dr. Ghassan Aboussita was there to discuss what the situation was in terms of healthcare and how anybody, whether you're in healthcare or not, can get involved in one way or another. And so that seminar hasn't been posted yet, but it will be posted on our website, glia.org. The second thing to say about that reflects what we do as an organization. So we made the deliberate choice to use an open source platform called Big Blue Button. Because one of the things that GLIA is anti-capitalist, right? We want knowledge production. We want access to be open to everyone. And so rather than using these corporate structures like Zoom, or these corporate platforms, I should say, like Zoom or Microsoft Suite or whatever the heck programs, we opted for Big Blue Button, which is fully open source. And it allows us to have a similar kind of online venue without being beholden to these corporate entities, many of whom are actually complicit in this genocide as well. And so we use that as an opportunity to further educate as well about other options, other technology options that are available to us that don't support genocide.
We're fast running out of time, Dorothea. Glia.org. Is there anywhere else you suggest that people go to get where you go to get information, or where they can best find out and inform themselves?
Yeah, I mean, heartily recommend the Electronic Intifada. They've been doing a fantastic job for a long time now covering the events in all of occupied Palestine. Mondo Weiss is also an incredibly valuable news source for understanding current events. Those would be the two main ones that I would suggest.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thanks a lot for coming on again, Dorothea. Strength and resilience, solidarity in crisis. Even the idea of solidarity is in crisis. We're seeing that everywhere, here in Canada and Britain and all of the Western countries being criminalized. That's all I've got for this week. Thanks also to Dylan Sullivan. And until the next time, thanks again, Dorothea.
Thank you.
Most come back empty-handed with stories of those killed and maimed at the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation Hunger Games. Was the cradle of civilization and the place where that all ended, where humans found new ways to show inhumanity that could never be defended. Israelis and Americans, to their eternal shame, who ran the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation Hunger Games. As the Gaza district becomes one big apocalypse.